Good.
All right, guys, good evening. My name is Bill Brown, a very grateful recovered crack cocaine addict. Talking to my buddies up here as they kind of got in here tonight, and I had to do some math, and most of you who know me, that doesn't always go very well. So this is their fifth summer in a row bringing the wall to us here at the Bridge of Hope. They've been to some other places, but every single year, man, they come back. I was thinking about what we've been doing in the last couple of months. I mean, we've had the presence of some great mentors in recovery out there. We've had access to Katie and Charlie, and Cliff has done a thing with us, and some other cats. I'm telling you right now, man, these guys are that for me, every single bit of it. They're my teachers. They're my mentors. I think most importantly, I can call them both my friends, guys that I trust with anything that I got going on in my world. And that's something special to me personally. It's something special to the Bridges. Roscoe's been here with us from the beginning of this thing, going back 5-6 years, and he's got these connections too, and he knows what I'm talking about. They're cutting out a piece of their life for us, guys. This is what it looks like. This thing is what any length looks like. Dude, this is a walking example. This is the demonstration, really. I want you to be aware of what's going on here. These guys, their lives are, man, they got a lot going on. And we're so just blessed that they're going to be here with us the entire weekend. I think it's so cool. I know that kind of when I got lined up with my current sponsor, going back about 6 years or so ago, that the sponsorship lineage and the DNA of that touches at some point. I'm going through a new set of steps. I was just telling these guys that brings us even closer. And I'm in a personal place right now that I'm so ready for this, maybe more than I ever have. And I guess that's the way it's supposed to be. And that's how the path shows up today. And I can't wait to be back there with my big book, highlighter, and a pen. But right now, I want to welcome these guys like you mean it. Bridges of Hope, Louisville, let's give it up for Tarek and Brady. Come on!
Now we're going to take it down and we're going to do a 2-minute meditation, and then when the meditation's done, there will be, we hope, a prayer up on the board, and then we'll say that together. You get the timer?
Yeah, so you can have your phone open.
So meditation starts now. Thank you. prayer. God,
please lay aside everything I think I know about addiction, alcoholism, the big boat, 12 steps, this workshop, myself, and especially you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience with all these things. Help me see the truth. Amen.
So this reading is called Opportunity. A green bird darting in the night. Will you be able to see it? Will you be able to catch it? Cling to spirit like a shadow. Move without a shadow. Times of oppression and adversity cannot last forever. How is the transition made to new and better situations? In the midst of great difficulty, a tiny opportunity will open, if only by chance. You must be sharp enough to discern it, quick enough to catch it, and determined enough to do something with it. If you let it pass, you will be filled with regrets. Stick to spirit like a shadow. Wherever it goes, you go. As soon as it throws something your way, catch it by sheer reflex. It is like the bird. If you try to catch it, you will miss. If you are always with it, moving at its speed, as much a part of it as its own shadow, then it is easy to seize it. When you act, however, you in turn must have no shadow. In other words, what you do must leave no messiness, no leftover consequences, nothing that will haunt you later. That is one of the ways in which you avoid creating more bad situations for yourself. Your every movement is traceless. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Brandon. Like Bill said, this is our fifth time coming here. And I can honestly say that when we came here and did this for the first time 5 years ago, that the people that we were sitting in front of the people where you're sitting were completely different people. I think that the reasons that we initially embarked on this was for one reason that we can spend some time talking about, not in this setting, and that the reason that we do it now is because every once in a while I'll be in a random meeting somewhere and some guy will come up to me and say, 5 years ago, you and Tarek did a workshop at the Bridges of Hope, and you said this, and it changed the way that I looked at that, and I've been sober ever since. Or I'll get a phone call, maybe even in the last 2 months, of a guy that sat through this. Now, his brother's struggling with alcoholism, and he wants somebody that has a story similar to his brother to talk to his brother, and his brother calls me. And that it's hard, I'll tell you, it's hard to be up here sometimes because there's a very small portion of the group here that actually cares to be here. There's a lot of people that are court ordered. There's a lot of people that their family made them come, that they're not going to stick around. There's a lot of people that maybe want to try something different, but they're not really ready to be done. And there's, you know, sitting in front of alcoholics and addicts, the most judgmental people on the planet, is not easy to do because your faces tell us all. You tell us what you're thinking, how you're approaching this, when you think we're full of shit, whether you got a better way. It's clear, and that's okay. Because when we were driving over here, Tarek actually, we were talking about it, and I'm 10 days away from 9 years from the day that I was struck sober. And, you know, probably somewhere in the last 4 or 5 days was the experience where for the longest time, I was continuing to live for what you might think about me, or my kids, or my wife, or my parents, or something. And somewhere around the 31st of May, I had this experience where I didn't want to be here anymore. Had no desire to live, didn't care what you thought about me, didn't care that my kids weren't going to have a dad anymore. None of that was important anymore. And I stood outside the room where I kept my pistol for seemingly hours, going back to the fridge, grabbing another beer, wondering why I couldn't go in the room and just take the gun and shoot myself in the face. It was the strangest thing. I was fully aware of the fact that I had resolved myself to make it happen, but yet I couldn't go in. As if there was a force field on a doorway that had no door, because I'm standing here, the pistol's in the cabinet right there, and I wasn't going in. My dog's sleeping on the concrete floor wondering what the hell I'm doing hanging outside this room. And me wondering the same thing. And at some point in time, I realized that it was probably not a good idea for me to be this drunk when my wife came home from hanging out with her friends. And so I put the kids in the car, drove over to a neighbor's house and asked if the kids could spend the night. And he was like, fine. And put the kids asleep in his house. And then I drove an hour away to my parents' house and tried to get into their house, but couldn't figure out how to get in. The key wasn't working. And I ended up passing out on their back patio with some patio cushions and beach towels and my dog. And next morning, waking up with my dad bumping me with his foot, wondering what the hell I'm doing on his back patio, and me realizing that I've made the fatal error of not having a story to tell him what I was doing there. So I asked him to go inside, basically so I could make up a story of why I was sleeping on his back patio. And he went inside, and this is the way I describe it, but this doesn't describe it, okay? Is in that time period, the air was crisper, the sun was brighter, the birds were louder, and the magnitude of the night before came down on me, and I realized I didn't want to die anymore. I want to live. And I knew that drinking had something to do with it, so I was afraid that if I kept drinking, I would go back to that place. And so fear absolutely sobered me up for 4 days. And 4 days later, I was back at it. And on June 15th, the Wednesday in the middle of a week, on an island with no bridge off the coast of South Carolina, on a family vacation with my wife and kids and her family, my wife announced to me and to her parents at the same time that she no longer wanted to be married to me. And the next morning, my mother-in-law suggested that perhaps I had a drinking problem, which was kind of news to me, which, if you really know my life story, that wouldn't have been news to anybody else, but it was news to me. And she asked me if I could quit drinking for the rest of my life, and I told her, yeah, except for, you know, weddings and funerals. And then that was the out loud list, and then there was this other list of lighting the grill and watching football and Sundays and Saturdays and rainy days and Tuesdays, and I realized that this list was infinitely long of all the reasons why I needed to drink. And that opportunity, that little window opened up to where maybe, just maybe, I was open to the idea that perhaps alcohol was a bigger deal to me than I thought. You see, because on that Wednesday night, when my wife announced that she no longer wanted to be married to me, I lost wife, car, kids, house, everything that I thought was important. So from that Wednesday to Saturday on that vacation, other than when my in-laws and my wife was telling me what was wrong with me, I was scheming and planning how I was going to make so much fucking money that she would regret the day that she ever left me. Okay? That was my plan. Just to show her, right? So we returned from vacation that Sunday night. I'm doing one of those weepy, snotty, cry things where I'm in bed, can't contain myself. She's sleeping in the guest room, and I get down on my knees and I pray to this God that I don't even really believe exists. And I said probably the most perfect prayer that I've ever said, which is, God, if you're out there, please make it better. And a calm came over me, climbed back up into bed, fell asleep, got up, refreshed the next morning, went to work, and they fired me. So you see, I couldn't die, and I couldn't live. And I was at this terrible, terrible spot where I could either change course or continue to do what I've always done. And then a series of circumstances fell into place that I ended up running into a buddy that had magically quit drinking a couple months prior, and he took me to my first meeting, and then I got hooked up with a bunch of people that you'll hear more about over the course of this weekend that changed, absolutely changed the course of my existence. Okay, so I had to go through all that. One day before I was struck sober, I had no desire to be sober. But when it happened, it happened. So if you're not ready, cool. Get some information from us. Listen to us. Does it seem like we're living our life different than you? Do you even care to live your life the way that we're living our life? You see, because I think that the thing that's lost on most people is in that short form of the 12th step over there on the wall, where it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, okay? So that's the first part of the 12th step. That's talking about steps 1 through 11. You can't do 12 until you do 1 through 11. We tried to carry this message to other alcoholics, which people talk about a lot. When they talk about the 12th step, they talk about that. But then there's this little third part to the 12th step that most people kind of gloss over. There's only 5 chapters devoted to it in the book, no big deal. But, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. That's what I hope we communicate to you over the course of this weekend, is how we're doing that. Okay? I want to tell you about my last Tuesday over a week ago. Not this last Tuesday, but the prior Tuesday. Probably one of the hardest days that I've lived through in recent memory. Okay? We're in a dispute with my stepchildren's father, and he's doing some pretty shady shit that's against Georgia law. Okay? But he happens to be in Massachusetts, and Massachusetts doesn't view custody things the same way that the state of Georgia does. So we did everything right. We did everything we were supposed to do. And on Tuesday, when we contacted the police in Massachusetts, they wouldn't do anything. They didn't care. They went by and they checked and made sure that the kids were okay, and that's it. In the state of Georgia, it's a felony what this guy's doing. Okay? So I'm having to deal with that, the frustration of doing everything right in my life and it not turning out the way that it's supposed to. Then I also have to deal with the mother of these children and how betrayed she feels by the system. And in the middle of that, I'm having a lot of conversations with Spirit, talking about how can this be happening? We're doing what's right. Right? There's a song out there that says, If God is with me, how can anyone be against me? Well, God's with all of us, and it's sometimes hard to see, right? So it was a difficult day. It was the first day I had been home It was the second day I had been home in 2 weeks. Since then, I've been home 2 additional days. So I've been home in the last 3 weeks, a total of like 4 days. I'll get to that in a second. And felt betrayed by the system. I had a lot of things I had to do before I got back out of town. And we had driven all night trying to pick the kids up. So I didn't get a lot of sleep. And it was one of those days where the world was coming at me. And I felt like I was at my limit. Okay. Now here's what's interesting. Tara probably could have seen it. My wife probably noticed. And there's probably 2 or 3 other people in my life that could have looked at me and seen that I was disturbed. The rest of the planet probably had no idea. Okay. Tuesday nights I get my kids. We went over to my sister's. My parents came over there and we had a cookout. And we got home that night. I spent some more time with my kids, and then we went to bed. And I crawled up next to Carrie, and all I said to her is, "How are you?" And she said, "I'm okay." And I'm not going to pretend to be a tough guy up here, guys, because apparently this story, 2 weeks later, I still can't get through it without getting choked up. But my wife said to me, she says, "You know, I went inside earlier and I was talking to your sister. And she said, I told her that there's no way I could have made it through this without you. And she said, the fact that you can stay calm, the fact that you can keep me calm, the fact that you can know the things to say, you can talk to the police, you can deal with the attorneys, you can write the letters, you can do all these things, and you can make me feel safe." In that moment, the day was worth it. The hardest day in memory was worth it because I was useful. I was useful to one of the most important people in my life. The woman that chose to call me her husband and the stepfather to her kids. And guys, I can tell you, there's a lot of stuff that we're going to say this weekend, but if the only thing you hear is that if you do this stuff and you start living in a way, you become useful. And if you don't feel useful, you feel worthless. And that what we're here for, told you I've been home 4 days in the last 3 weeks. Okay? I'm going to go through the roll call. I got 6 ducks, 2 emus, probably 30 some hogs, more chickens than I can count, like 15 goats, 16 goats. One was born last night. I got a job that keeps me on the road. Until recently, you know, I've always got 2 or 3 guys that I'm taking through the steps. I am available to people to take 10-step calls. I do all this stuff, right? My life is full. I don't have to be here. I absolutely do not have to be here. But I'm sacrificing my time because I think it's important enough that you guys hear it. Okay? So, if you don't care what we have to say, that's fine. But just realize that we got other shit we could be doing right now. But we're here. Because this is some of the most important stuff that we do. Is to try to just, if we can, change your life that much. Maybe disturb you on alcoholism and drug addiction. And get you possibly moving in a direction that leads to a life where you can be useful.
Thanks, Brandon. I'm Tarek. I'm an addict.
Tarek.
Yeah, I've been continuously clean and sober since the morning of November 5th, 2007. I haven't found it necessary to put a mind-altering substance in my body to change the way I feel or to stop my brain from moving or my mind from moving since that date. But that doesn't mean I haven't used other things. Just because we lay down the drugs and the alcohol doesn't mean that addictive process that lives inside of us just goes away. It latches on to other things, and it needs to because it has to live. And it's still living in me today. I've just learned how to commune with it, sort of, and observe some of the time, and not all the time, but much more than I could observe 3 years ago. And 3 years from now will be much more than I can observe today. But that requires effort and that requires practice. If you ask me why I came to the Bridges this year, and if I were to tell you I came to carry the message in hopes of it being delivered to whoever it gets delivered to, because all I can do is really carry the message, and the universe is the postman, God, universe, same thing for me. But that's not a complete answer. Because I think spending time with Bill and Roscoe is up at the top of the list, and spending time with this guy is also at the top of the list. But you know what? All of those relationships are based on an understanding and an agreement. It's not like an agreement we acknowledged verbally amongst each other, but we all have lasting and meaningful connections because we're all active 12-step workers. There's something there in that. There's a connection there. It's like one of the big book calls the 12-step a foundation stone. And so, yeah, I came here this weekend because I enjoy trying to excite people about the program of recovery outlined in the big book. And we're not going to get all mechanical on you guys this weekend. We're going to share our experience. You guys get all the mechanics you need at the Bridges because I know how Bill runs this place and I know how Roscoe runs it. And so we don't want to bore you with mechanics. What we want to do is we want to share our experience with the way of life that the big book describes. As Brandon was talking, I kept on thinking about this part of the book that talks about matching calamity with serenity. And that was the description he gave you. And then I was reading in another book, and I have another group of guys, and we talk about this a good bit, that calamity is our providence. And we really find out what it means to make a decision or a choice that God is everything in the middle of calamity. And it's that acknowledgement of, I think, God's presence in the middle of the calamity. And sometimes God is the calamity. I'm a guy that thinks he's always the calamity, but that's up for debate. But that's where that's our proving ground, is the calamity. That's why, providence is almost like a place you get to where you experience the knowledge of God through realization of an experience, not through reading anything. Not through theorizing about anything. You actually have a direct experience. Some people have that experience bestowed upon them. Some people don't. We don't know who is and who isn't going to have that experience. But I do know, as Brandon was giving you guys his description, it's one of those things that resonates deeply in me when I start to reflect on my own recovery. And those cornerstones, if you will, have always been based on moving through what we use the word calamity to describe. Events moving in your life that are not pleasurable, that are not delightful, that create some despair, they create some anguish. And then there are some of us, I think, that are blessed enough. And yeah, I did use the word, there's a blessing going on here. My sponsor says we get a blessing so we can be a blessing. Right, that's one of his favorite sayings, and I love it because I see how legit it really is to live that way. And for me, sharing those parts of my experience are going to be more important to me this weekend than telling you about all the cool shit that God has done. Because God's done some pretty cool shit in my life. He's done a lot. I've known Brandon the entire time he's been here. I've watched what he's done with Brandon and a bunch of other guys. And but what creates a need to have God in my life is always has calamity around it a lot. And I find that as I approach my conception of God, there's an increased sincerity when I am using God as my sanctuary and my refuge. And it's a quite baffling to understand that in the second step proposition, God is everything, which means all the events taking place in the world right now are an expression of God. You know, that's the way I like to look at it, because I'm able to not spend as much time talking about the ignorance that's out in the world and the people that are making bad decisions, although I do go to that place. But then I flip back to the other place. Well, this is, you know, this is part of God. It's unfolding. We don't know what's happening. And then I'm able to sit still, and then it's a constant flipping back and forth. But what's important here is, regardless of the shitstorm going on in our personal lives or in the world at large, where are we going for our sanctuary? Are we constantly trying to distract ourselves and not really facing this head on, so to speak, in terms of how it can influence our spiritual growth? And to me, you know, for years, there's these things on page 52 called the bedevilments. And I would say to myself, if I'm experiencing the bedevilments on page 52, then I'm not in fit spiritual condition. My life's unmanageable. I'm suffering from untreated alcoholism. I don't believe that anymore, because how can you not be spiritually fit if you've got some personal relationships that are under stress? If you're feeling a little bit of misery, you might be going through a bout of depression. You might feel worthless or useless. You might be terrified about something going on in your life, and you're continuously turning to God over and over and over and over. How can you not be in fit spiritual condition? All right? And I'm not saying I live a life where I want those things to be occurring in my life all the time. Yeah, but the idea of, if I work the 12 steps hard enough, these things I'll keep them at bay, that hasn't proven true in my experience either. And you'll be hard pressed to find someone that's more committed to this process than I am. I'm not saying I'm the most committed, but you'll be hard for us to find people more committed. And because I attack this like I attack smoking crack. I mean, that's the easiest way I can put it. For whatever reason, the street mentality that I had down on the block or the corner followed me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous. That's just the way it's played out with me. Right? And I always like good dope, and I want good recovery, so I'm not going to sit here and play around and hang out with a bunch of people that are going to pussyfoot. I just have never been that guy, and I never will be that guy. And I'm okay with that. And so what I want to talk about, and I'm going to share a little bit of my experience around the what happened portion of my story, I think. So throughout the course of the weekend, you know, my friend Charlie says this, and the first time I heard him say it, it was so like right on. I may tell you I'm going to talk about something later on, and it probably means I'm not going to talk about it. But if you want to remind me that I said I was going to talk about it, feel free to remind me, because that way I'll definitely go back to it. But we've got so much. Brandon and I, and this is not from an egotistical place, but we've been doing this work for so long. We just have so many experiences. I guess at some point, maybe we were terrified the first time. We've done so many of these. Maybe at the beginning, we were like, man, what are we going to talk about for like 9 hours? And now I can tell you that 9 hours is not enough time for us to talk about everything. But we're going to do our best. And I want to start with this thing I stumbled across this week that I found quite interesting. It says, why we were chosen. God, in his wisdom, selected this group of men and women to be the purveyors of his goodness. He went not to the proud, the mighty, the famous, or the brilliant. He went to the humble, the sick, the unfortunate. He went straight to the drunkards and the addicts, the so-called weaklings in this world. What might have God said to us? Unto your weak and feeble hands I have entrusted a power beyond estimate. To you has been given that which has been denied the most learned of your fellows, not to scientists, nor to statesmen, not to wives or mothers, not even to my priests or ministers have I given this gift of healing other alcoholics and addicts, which I entrust to you. It must be used unselfishly, for it carries with it grave responsibility, sometimes the difference between life and death. No day can be too long. No demands upon your time can be too urgent. No case too pitiful. No task too hard. No effort too great. and must be used with tolerance, for I have restricted its application to no race, no creed, and no denomination. Personal criticism you must expect. Lack of appreciation will be common. Ridicule will be your lot. Your motives will be misjudged. You must be prepared for adversity, for what men call adversity is the ladder you must use to ascend the rungs towards spiritual perfection. And remember, in the exercise of this power, I shall not exact of you beyond your capabilities. You are not selected because of exceptional talents. Be careful always, if success attends your efforts, not to ascribe to personal superiority that to which you lay claim only by virtue of my gift. If I had wanted eloquent men, there would have been many anxious for the assignment, for talk is the easiest use of all the talents in which I have endowed mankind. If I had wanted scholarly men, the world is filled with better qualified men than you who would be available. You were selected because you have been the outcasts of the world, and your long experience as drunkards and addicts has made or should make you humbly alert to the crisis of distress that come from the lonely hearts of alcoholics and addicts everywhere. Keep ever in mind the admission you made on the day of your profession in Alcoholics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Heroin Anonymous, that you are powerless, and it was only with your willingness to turn your life and will into my keeping that relief has come to you. John T., 4th anniversary of the Chicago Group, October 5th, 1943. And so I wanted to read that because I knew one of us was going to read the other one out of the Tao book about the opportunity. But they both had this word adversity. Nobody comes into the rooms of the Alcoholics Anonymous or the Bridges of Hope on a winning streak. We all know that, right? And one thing I know for sure is prior to your time here, things were not going well in your life. Right, I already know things about you, and I haven't talked to the majority of you. But these are things I know because I've been there. You know, my experience with mind-altering substances centered mostly on crack cocaine. I did heroin. I smoked meth. I loved my benzos. I loved alcohol. I liked the synthetic drugs like DMT and 2CB and all that stuff. I mean, I loved all of it. But when the big book talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, which I call the list of things we all had this list, right, that I'm never going to do this to get high. I'm never going to do this to get high. I'm never going to do this to get high. And it was like as I was making the list of what I wasn't going to do, I was actually making the list of the things I was going to do to get high. But only one substance made me do the things on the list. Cocaine. Rock cocaine. That's what did me in. When Bill Wilson talks about being overwhelmed and, you know, quicksand stretched out in all directions, that bitter morass of self-pity, he met his master. For him, it was alcohol. For me, it was crack cocaine. Does that mean I can drink or do anything else? No, because I'm still powerless over all those other things. I'm just not powerless over them the same way I am over crack cocaine. You know, I steal for crack cocaine. I pawn things for crack cocaine. I become incarcerated because of crack cocaine. I file bankruptcy because of crack cocaine. I lose my home because of crack cocaine. Every time I went to treatment, if you asked me why I was there, I said crack cocaine. Never said alcohol. Never said heroin. Never said meth. I did all those things. But for me, it was that I'm so clear on what my first step is. I sponsor guys today where I don't have to get this clear with them. You know, some guys I can see, okay, I can go there with this guy. This guy, you know what, I just need to get him through the steps. It don't matter. Or I used to be, oh, everyone has to do it that way. I'm not that anymore. But what I do is I want to attempt to meet the person that I'm taking through the steps to where they're at. So if I think they can handle a dissection like that into what is your master? Because once you have, like, clarity is a marvelous thing just to have clarity. Right, and for years I bounced around all these fellowships. Man, I go to treatment. You're an alcoholic, right? I'd raise my hand. I never went on a fucking drinking spree. Wouldn't that be an alcoholic? You gotta go on drinking sprees, right? I never went on a drinking spree, right? I drank. I would lose control, but as soon as cocaine or any other mind-altering substance, other alcohol came in the picture, there was no more drinking going on. Right? I would assume an alcoholic would keep on drinking, but I didn't. And so this is just for me. Right? So I go to AA every once in a while, but I don't introduce myself as an alcoholic. I introduce myself as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous because of the third tradition. I have an honest desire to not drink alcohol because it's going to take me back to cocaine. And so that's why I break all that down, and we're going to get deeper into that. And so as a result of my relationship with crack, I lost three incredible careers. As I stated earlier, I lost my home. I filed bankruptcy. I was incarcerated. I got kicked out of grad school. I torched all the relationships that were of any value in my life. Nobody that was close to me trusted me. And on the morning of November 5th, 2007, I found myself in a jail cell in Duval County, Florida. I had a drug trafficking ecstasy and an intent to distribute cocaine, two charges. And I spent 5 weeks in that jail. But what happened to me on the morning of November 5th is the first thought I had was not a thought that I came to after a logical train of thoughts in my mind and I came to this realization. It was almost like something was injected into my consciousness. And it was the realization that my new sobriety date, because I've been bouncing in and out of these fellowships since the middle of 2004, and now we're talking November 07, my new sobriety date was my buddy Jason's birthday. And Jason was a friend of mine who overdosed on my birthday in 2003, right? And so, like, sitting in that jail cell, it was almost like God or the universe was trying to communicate with me. And there was nothing in me was discounting it. I took it as a form of communication. I didn't see it as a coincidence. I said, this has meaning. There's a purpose behind why I'm having this realization. And I spent the next 5 weeks in that jail, and they passed books around the jail. And I read two books, and these two books, one was called Live Your Best Life Now, and the other book was called Exceeding Gratitude for the Creator. And I kept reading in these books things I'd heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, things I'd heard in Cocaine Anonymous. And so the message that I was receiving was like, you need to go back. Right? And so as I started to think about this, again, there was... I had no plans or designs. I wasn't trying to manipulate my way out of the situation. I wasn't trying to say, this is horseshit. I need to develop my own plan. It was like I was going with the flow. I'm going back. And then I started to have like these visions of this guy, Dante, in Atlanta. And he had tried to carry the message, him and a couple other guys, about a year and a half before. And Dante was one of those individuals that sat in the back of the room. It was a Friday night CA meeting, about 150 people in Atlanta. And he closed every Friday night. You always knew he was going to be the last person to share. And he always had some profound shit that he was going to say. At least I thought it was profound. But every once in a while, he'd say some shit like this. And excuse my profanity, but he said, if you're new, we suggest not sharing in the meeting. And after you've worked these steps and made some amends and developed, you know, practices in the 10th and 11th step, and you've started to carry the message to other people, then we want you to come and share with us. But until then, you don't have a damn thing to offer this meeting. All right? And me being a new person, I was like, who the F does this guy think he is? He doesn't know me. I've got so much to offer this group of people. All right? No matter how...
And being that you were sensitive...
Very sensitive.
Because anybody in here sensitive?
And I was definitely sensitive in those meetings where Dante would say those things. And but for some reason, he was the guy coming into my consciousness. And I said, okay, I'm going to go find this guy once I get out of here. And my family wanted nothing to do with me. I called home. Mom and Dad said no. Brother said no. My best friend said no. So I got no one left. Now standing at that turning point for me, that was it. Like, I remember hanging up the phone and be like, I ain't got nobody else left. I've torched every other relationship, which was a really good place to get to because it meant there was no one left to like attempt to manipulate. But the fascinating thing that there wasn't a desire to manipulate in me. It was just realization after realization after realization. And so there was a guy who I was friends with who used to, you know, engage in the same entrepreneurial activity that I did, he got me a lawyer. And my lawyer said, so I finally get this arraignment date. So they were going to read me my charges and all this stuff. And so, granted, I had no communication with my family up to this point. And we go to court, and they've got me shackled to a bunch of grown men, my ankles, my wrists, and they take us into the, like, we're set off in this little box in the courtroom, and then there's a gallery, and then, you know, lawyers and the judge. And my lawyer approaches, and I was like, hey, have you talked to my mom? And he goes, yeah, she's right here in the gallery, right? And I remember turning, and it was like she was to my right behind me, and it was like tunnel vision. And it was like the like when Brandon described that the sun was brighter, the air was crisper, the birds were louder, that, like, my senses were heightened in that moment. So it was an experience that was unlike the normalcy of life. Like, I was like, it was very stark, and I noticed differences about it. And I remember looking at my mom and I's eyes connected, and her eyes were sunk in her head because she had not eaten. Like, she was not eating, and she hadn't slept, and I could see it on her. And she was frail, super skinny, and she almost collapsed in the courtroom. And that was when I was, as another friend of mine says, that's when I was split wide open. There was something in me died in that moment. I don't know what it was that died. And then something at the same exact time was born. And what was born was a degree of willingness I had never experienced before. And it was based on not accepting the circumstances of, like, acceptance was not the key to my fucking life in that situation, right? That was not. Unacceptance was the key, was the answer in that situation. Because what became unacceptable was living life in such a way that I did that to the people that cared the most about me, right? I hope to God you're fucking sick and tired of the bridges. I do. And Bill knows what I mean by this. You couldn't be in a better place. But I hope it's unacceptable to you that you have to be in a place like this. And then from a place of unacceptance, you will take the necessary action so you don't ever have to be in a place like this again.
Unless by choice.
And so that's one of the things I'd like to leave you with this weekend is, has your way of life proved, you know, the Big Book talks about coming to believe in the futility of life as you have been living it. You have to believe that before you even believe, before you concede to your innermost self. Maybe you do both at the same time. Concede to your innermost self that you're an addict or an alcoholic, and concede to yourself in the futility of the way you live life. Because that's what we have. This is a way of life that it's a way of life that allows us to live. It's not a way of life so we don't drink. My mode of living wasn't very satisfactory before. It just wasn't. I was full of fear. I didn't really have a sense of direction or purpose. And I felt like I didn't belong in a lot of the places I was in, even though you could never tell. The sense of not belonging was always experienced internally. Right? And that's why alcohol and drugs were so powerful, because they made all that shit go away temporarily. When they let me out of that treatment center, they let me out of jail. I went to treatment. I had to do 90 days inpatient. I get there, and I'm like, you guys got to get me to this CA meeting because there's a guy named Dante I got to find. And I got to the treatment center on a Tuesday or Wednesday, and I they didn't want to drive 35, 40 minutes. You know, I was up in the north. I was 40 minutes north of Atlanta and coming. And the treatment center I was in, and the meeting I wanted to go to was in Sandy Springs. So it was a little bit of a drive, 35, 40 minutes, and I was in a treatment center that had 17 guys, right? I think, I'm still not sure on the number, but of those 17 guys, I'm the only one clean and sober, and it's 6 or 7 of them are dead now. I don't know if that's a reflection of what the chances are here. I think the 12 steps work 100% of the time. It's just very few people work the 12 steps. That's why, it's really misinformation to say our success rates are like 3 and 5%. What that should really say is 3 to 5% of the people actually work the steps. That's what it should say. And so I ended up, convincing them to take the druggy buggy down to Sandy Springs on Friday night. And we were late getting to the meeting. And their guy, Dante, and there was another guy who I also thought about while I was in jail. His name is Randy. He was sponsored by Dante. And when we got to the church that night, I didn't know how to contact either one of them. And we got to the church late, and it was raining, and there was an awning. And there's one person outside on their phone, and the meeting's going on. And I get out of the van, I run up to the church, and it's the guy, Randy. And so I took my opportunity, and I said, "Hey, man, will you help me?" And I asked him to work with me. And I told him I'd do anything to not live the way I was living or die. Right? And we met once a week. And we covered one chapter every week. We did the third step in a closet, a storage closet. I wrote inventory. I did a fifth step that lasted like 6 or 7 weeks, 3 hours every Sunday. He made me read every single bit of it. And then when I had about 4 months, 5 months if you count the 5 weeks I was in jail, I started sponsoring. And I started making amends. And I started, you know, I was praying every day, but I did nothing with meditation for another year. And I had prison time. My lawyer worked out a deal. I was going to go to prison for 3 years. And I was going to hopefully get work camp and some other stuff they were trying to work out. And so I was terrified. I didn't want to go to prison. And I sure as hell didn't want to go to prison in the state of Florida when I live in Georgia. And so my sponsor and Dante, I would have conversations with them. And both of them would tell you these stories about, well, if you go to prison, there's going to be someone in prison to carry the message to. And I hated when they would tell me that. And but, you know, it was something I had to consider. And they would always point me to page 68 in our big book. "God, please remove my fear and direct my attention that what you would have me be." I bet you I can't tell you how many times I said that prayer in the first year of my recovery. But one thing I did was I believed both Randy and Dante said to me that if you go back to what you were doing, your life is not going to end well. But I promise you, if you keep making these amends and you keep helping people, that you're going to be able to get through whatever it is. And I believed that. Right? And so that's what I did. And my court case kept getting continued. I kept documenting my progress, and so my progress every time I took a drug screen. I got back into school. I was working two jobs, one of which was overnight staff at a treatment center. I got my own apartment, and I had all of this paperwork to document my progress, right? And I'd never been arrested before. I had two Schedule A felonies or whatever. They were bad felonies, but still, I was first-time offender. And so my lawyer has a meeting to file a motion to suppress evidence because there was a 50-50 shot we could get the motion passed because we didn't really like the way they detained me and searched me and all that stuff. And so my lawyer meets with the district attorney on August 5th, 2008. So this is 9 months, exactly 9 months. And the district attorney dropped all the charges. And the reason I told you what the charges were because I wanted you to see how severe these charges were. Right, and I had no probation, no community service, nothing to expunge off my record. I had a bunch of amends that I had to go make that were with drug dealers, like people that used to give me stuff on the front, and I would go and sell, and I would come back and pay them their bill. And these were large quantities, and thousands and thousands, and in one situation, way more than $1,000. But these are amends that I've made over my time here. And, you know, there was a handful of them that were terrified to meet with me because they thought I was a narc. They thought I'd ratted somebody. And no one understood. I couldn't go to them and say God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. That would not fly. So it was some of those amends were super difficult. But I made them. And some of them just wouldn't meet with me, which I got. But my job was to make them know, to acknowledge my desire to meet with them to make things right. And so when the big book talks about, if you read these pages, we hope no further authentication was necessary. They're talking about, if you read this book and you read our experiences, we hope you don't have to go out and do any more research, right? But it meant something different to me. When it's like that morning, as I stood in my kitchen and my lawyer called me to give me the news that the charges were dropped, that was a miracle. Like that was like a witnessing of an event that you cannot explain how that happened. I was already, I mean, I knew I was going to jail, right? I had already like mentally prepared myself and now it's all gone. And so I remember standing in my kitchen that morning and thinking to myself, no further authentication is necessary. I'm doing whatever this big book says from now until the day God takes me out of this body, or takes the spirit that, you know, is lives in this body. However you want to put it. I mean, I choose to believe that has something to do with why I have been so committed to this process for over 12 and a half years. And that happened early on. It was fuel. I was already on fire. That shit just dumped gasoline on me. And so I've been accused of all kinds of things over the years. Being a big book thumper. Thank you. I'll take that one as a compliment. Of being a big book Nazi. I don't even know how someone has a heart that can use the word Nazi, right? I'm only saying it right now because I gotta repeat what somebody has called me, right? I've been militant is another one that's been used. And I used to be fire and brimstone. I'm not as much anymore. I don't think there's just one way to do this process. It's open to interpretation. But I do believe the structure is in this book. Now, the way we interpret the instructions in the book, that's open to interpretations. But the instructions are pretty... It says further on, clear-cut instructions are given or directions. And that's the what happened part of my story. I think it's important for me to share that because I think everyone sitting in this room has a turning point. And turning points are always rooted in a genuine surrender. And it's the death of something. And that something is what I describe today as your way of doing things. It has to die. That's what died for me. I was willing to turn myself over to someone else and say, hey, you tell me what to do. All right, you lead me to the promised land. Right, that's the way I look at it today. I didn't know it was the promised land back then. But life is understood in reverse, right? In the rear view. And it's lived moving forward. But we have to reflect on the experiences we've had. So I hope it's unacceptable that you are in a place like this. I really do. But if you're cool with being here, I'm sorry, but chances are you're not done. Yeah. And when I say that, I don't mean fight Bill and Roscoe and try to like be a pain in the ass and like that's your way of showing you don't want to be here. That's not what I mean. I'm hoping you guys understand really what I mean by saying that. All right. Well, let's take our first break. We'll come back in 15 minutes.